Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 4.
Len, you've told us that we were up to the point where you said you had been accepted for the Air Force, but then there was a delay. What happened to you in that time?
Well, because I was a driver and rather, my duties were required, I had to wait until August before I was eventually released. And it was a hectic period between March and August because the heavy bombing meant that I had virtually no home life at all. I'd come home dirty and tired and spend the night in the air raid shelter, which was in the garden shared with the next door neighbour. And food was short, and I had a little baby daughter which my wife was worried about, and yet she wouldn't leave me and go to her mother in Edinburgh because she thought it was unfair to leave me coming home. And that was one of the reasons that I'd applied to join the Air Force, as much as anything, to get her to go out of London. Anyway, I remember on one occasion coming home on my bicycle down past the Kingston Vale Cemetery, and the raid was in progress, and I could hear bombs falling, and I could realise that they were coming. A stick was coming very, very close to where I was standing or cycling. I jumped off my bicycle and took shelter at the foot of a big yard-thick gatepost to the Kingston Vale Cemetery. And sure enough, one of the bombs fell, I suppose 50 to 80 yards away, just on the other side of the cemetery gate, and the shockwave shifted the coping stone on top of this gatepost a few inches over towards where I was resting. But anyway, it didn't come over, so that was one of many things. I remember a colleague, Leslie Brown, who also lived close by in Vale Crescent there, he's dead now, poor lad, but he was involved in a cottage just at the top of Roehampton Lane that was demolished as he was passing, and he spent hours getting people out of that and came home, as we mostly did, exhausted and covered in rubble and dust. And this was the I can't remember the exact incidents, but there were many incidents like that when I was waiting, anxiously waiting to get into the Air Force, but still having to go through the worst of the Blitz bombing. Putney had a hell of a bashing, and was famous that the cinema, well, the pub in Putney Bridge Road was hit, and I think 156 casualties there. They were all put into the cinema, which was a temporary mortuary. Things like that were daily events that we became benumbed. We were numb to it, all the feeling of it all, and so it was with great delight that when my call up came, I think it was on the 8th of August, we were told to report to Lord's Cricket Ground, which I did, and we went through inoculations. It formed in rows to go through, I forget the name of the building where we went through in continuation of Baker Street towards the Lord's Cricket Ground. Many people healed over because they had so many injections all at the same time. And anyway, after that we went in and were kitted up with uniform. I think there was a big old ex-garage that they were issuing the uniform out. Anyway, we finished up with all our kit, and we had to assemble in the Lord's Cricket Ground, and we paraded, and we had photographs taken, allocated temporary digs. I remember I had to go to Viceroy Court, which was an elegant block of flats just in, what's the name of the road? Just along between the Prince Albert Road, it was Viceroy Court in Prince Albert Road, and I suppose there were a couple of dozen of us in that building, and others were spread over other buildings around. And we had to march up from there to the zoological gardens. The restaurant at the zoological gardens was where we received our food. And there were many amongst us of these new intakes, well, this new intake that I was in, never worn boots before, and this marching up to Lord's Cricket Ground, they came back in agony. Fortunately, as a policeman, and a few of us who were policemen there, were able to survive that ordeal. We were accustomed to wearing boots, but...
Did you recognise some of the other recruits as being police officers?
Yes, I did, but none of my specific or close friends were in that intake. They were policemen, but I didn't know them. But as I say, we survived a little better than some of the others because we'd already been in uniform and had drill practice and training, so it didn't come strange to us. After Lord's Cricket Ground Assembly, we were then sent to various initial training wings, and I think some went to Torquay, and I went with half my assembled flight to Scarborough, 7ITW at Scarborough. And because I was a policeman, I was appointed cadet flight commander of the intake up at Scarborough. And part of my duties were to march the lads up and down, give them drill training and practice. And I think that was, it stood me in good stead, in fact, because I was cadet flight commander and in charge of the contingent, when we eventually posted for our training, which in my case proved to be in the United States, where I was part of the Arnold training scheme, because we had no idea where we were going after that, but we travelled at night, and we were considering whether we were going to Liverpool. But eventually we finished up on at Gourock on the Tyne. And we went on board a great big liner, which we didn't know the name of, but we later found its name, and which was the SS Pasteur, which had been a big French pleasure boat which had been commandeered by the Britons, the British. Anyway, we went on to this, and because I was cadet flight commander, I was able to choose the berth that I wanted, and I chose an outside berth near an Orlican gun placement on the upper deck, because the rest of it was conditions for inside were overcrowded, many people were sick, and the heads were very unpleasant, with swilling up and down in the rough weather and so on. It was just as well that I'd chosen an outside place to spend my time. We must have been considered a very valuable cargo, those of us on board, because we were escorted by, there was an armed merchantman, two destroyers, and an aircraft carrier that were escorting us across the North Atlantic, and it was really, really rough weather. And looking out, as I was able to, being on an outside position, I could see these destroyers, one on either side of us, just going through the water as if they were submarines. They'd go under the water and come out again, minutes later, and shedding all the water off their decks and so on. And I wondered how anyone could live under such conditions in such boat. And I have great admiration for the Navy and the people who manned those destroyers, because life must have been hell for them. Anyway, we got across the Atlantic in due course, and we went into Halifax, Nova Scotia. And we disembarked there and got into a temporary camp. And I think I can remember the name. I think it was Moncton in Canada that we went across to from there, and to temporary digs until, I can't remember whether it was a day or 2 days. We had, we were in heaven. We went into mess halls and had as much bread, thin, white, fluffy bread as we could eat, and fried bacon and eggs. We thought we were in paradise with the, as far as the food was concerned. We were.
And what time would this have been?
In November, November time. It was really
November 42.
November 42, and the train journey. I remember the train journey went down the track went alongside the St. Lawrence River for much of the way, until it got to Windsor and Detroit area, and most of it was in darkness, so we couldn't see much of it, what was happening outside. And eventually we got down to Montgomery in Alabama, which was the central central depot for the Southeastern Air Corps Flying Center. And we went into barracks down there under American control. And because it was almost Armistice Day, the 11th of November, we were issued with rifles. We never had a rifle in our hands before up until then, but we had to march up and down and practice. And we, because we were going to be involved in a parade right through the town, Montgomery, up to the Capitol Hill, and we joined in with the American forces, and we had a grand parade for the November 11th Armistice Day. And you should remember this was before Pearl Harbor.
So this, in fact, was November 41.
November 41, just before Pearl Harbor. And it was while we were at Montgomery, before having been posted to our respective training stations around, that Pearl Harbor broke out. And there was panic everywhere, and people were taxiing aircraft at dispersal areas and so on, and I think that was when there was a great change of attitude in America to the training of pilots over there. We were broken up into groups again, so that any groups that you'd formed previously, you broke up and you were sent to various stations, and I was sent to Lakeland in Florida as the primary training school. And I have a photograph which shows us all down there. There must have been 100 or so of us on parade there. We were allocated to in little groups of 4 or 5 to various instructors. And my instructor was a chap called Green, who had been a crop sprayer. He was a civilian co-opted into the American Air Force as an instructor. He'd been a crop sprayer, and he took us up each in turn just to show us what the aircraft was like. It was a Stearman, PT-13A Stearman. He took each one of us up. I think there were 4 of us in our group, and let us hold the controls and fly it. And then he brought us down again and talked about the flight and what we were to do. And then he individually took us up and allowed us to take over the controls and to feel what the aircraft was like and what it did. And I remember when I got back after that, one of these first trips up in my Stearman, he said to me, "Len," he said, you've flown before, haven't you?" I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Yes, you have." He said, "I can tell you've flown before." And I must admit that I felt very happy in that aircraft. It was just like getting on a bicycle and riding that you'd ridden before, but the controls and instincts of controls became very natural to me, and And he said, look, whatever you say, he said, you've either flown before, or he said, it's born in you. And I do know that, whereas most of the other chaps with me took 7, 8, 9 hours before they were allowed to solo, he sent me up after 2.5, 2.75 hours dual flying to go solo. And I soloed, I think, quicker than anyone was on the course. Because, you know, it seemed to be a talent which I had with no reason, no particular reason that I had it, but I had it. And it was flying from that day onwards, became a natural instinct with me. I think at the end of that course, of course, there were three flying courses. There was the primary, the intermediate, and the flying, and each one was done at a different airfield around the Arnold scheme, or the Southeast Air Corps, a group of aerodromes. And after that, after we'd soloed and done all our initial flying, which was delightful. In fact, it was there that instinctively we were taught to do aerobatics, because these little biplanes, you could do anything with them, and we used to go out line abreast and do what we called rat racing through the clouds. And if you get a day with some lovely cumulus, light cumulus clouds, we'd go in line following each other, and following a green, he would lead us through the clouds, up and down and round and over, and we found we were doing loops, upside down, rolls, everything instinctively, just following each other around these clouds. And from that day, flying the aeroplane has been as it was in those days, although I never, any of the bigger ones that I flew, I didn't loop the loop or do anything silly with them, but the instinct was there that flying was a very, very automatic and simple thing to do. Anyway, after that episode of flying on Stearman's, we went to Macon in Georgia. And
Len, at this time, how were the American people treating you?
Well, in the mess halls, they tried to make us the same discipline as the American students, who were all college, you know, graduates. And the discipline was rather foolish. It had to sit square at the table and sit, try and eat in the American way of eating, with the knife and fork and so on, which is completely strange to us. And because I was cadet flight commander, I had to go and see the CO, the American CO, and say, look, we lads, because they threatened to send discharge some of the lads who'd broken the rules. And I said, look, we've come over here for a specific purpose, to learn how to fly to aeroplanes so that we can go back and fight the war in Great Britain. And I said, we don't want any of this silly, petty hazing and silly behaviour. I said, we'll conform to the rules of good behaviour and things like that, but we don't want any silly hazing to affect the outcome of our training. And from then on, they did relax, and we had to still conform to the discipline of making our beds up correctly and things like that, but there was none of this silly walking around the ground, flapping your arms up and down like an air, like a bird, you know, because you'd broken a rule. So I suppose I had an effect on the outcome of our British lads over there. And that, I suppose, continued into the next stage, because it didn't continue when I went on to the intermediate course at Desney, Alabama. We didn't get any of that silly hazing. And by then, the Americans realized that they would have to increase their training, because they were in the war by then. They would have to increase their training capacity for their own pilots, and they had no one left to train them. And so eventually, many of the students who went through with me were earmarked and left, kept over there as instructors to teach subsequent classes of British and American students how to fly. And it was the case of lease lend in reverse. So we were supplying instructors for them to be taught to fly. And
what about your relationship with American civilians?
Well, that was very good. Each weekend there would be a list. Well, right at the beginning of the course, there was a list put up for anyone who wanted to go to an American family for the weekend. That was from Saturday lunchtime right through till Monday morning, or Sunday night, to put their tick their name against the list of people who would take them for the weekend. And I had a very pleasant, a strange experience, because you realise I was married and I had a little girlie back home. And yet I didn't want to be kept over there as an instructor. I wanted to get back to them. And as the rumours were that the older of the students and the more mature ones would be kept on as instructors. So I kept very quiet about it. I know the record showed that I was married, but I didn't talk about it to anyone else. And when I got this invitation to go out one weekend, I think it was Mr. and Mrs. Lipford, they had a son who was away, a cadet training in the Navy, and a daughter at the Wesleyan Girls College. Anyway, I went to this home of Litwits on my first weekend out. I was picked up and taken to their home, and Charming took us around to the clubs and things that they belong to, and Mr. Lipford said to me, he said, "Len, as you've been an experienced car driver, squad driver back in London," he said, "I think I can trust you to drive one of my cars." And he said, "Next weekend when you break up on Saturday lunchtime," he said, "I'll have one of my cars waiting at the gate of the camp for you to bring home, to come home in." He said, "There's one thing I would ask you, and that is, before you come home, would you go to the Wesleyan Girls College and pick up my daughter Betty? She's a 17-year-old girl there, and she would like to come home for the weekend and meet you, and meet us all." So the next weekend, sure enough, there was this big 6-seater open Cadillac waiting outside the camp gates, and everyone was... well, not alarmed, but shocked to see me get into it and drive it away. And I was in uniform, of course. And when I arrived at the Wesleyan Girls College to pick up his daughter Betty, and drove onto the campus, all the upper class girls crowded around the car and were intrigued to find out what I was doing. And when I said, "I've come to pick up Betty Lipford," obviously she knew that she was going to be picked up, but she made a great show of being absent, so that they all had to call her. And anyway, Betty came in and and I took her home. And she and her parents took every step to give us a lovely time that weekend. And I was taken out to golf courses and yachting and swimming pools and horse riding and all the thing, anything that I wanted I could have had, because the family were well established, and in fact I think had founded one of the founding members of the country club there. This didn't interrupt with my flying, because I got on with flying. We were flying Vultees, which was a single wing monoplane but with a fixed undercarriage, similar to the next stage, which would have been the Harvard, but it had a fixed undercarriage, which meant that we one thing less to worry about when you were flying, putting your undercarriage down to land, which so far we hadn't experienced. So I got on with my flying and did all the various routine exercises, cross-country runs and things like that, which over there means flying the pipeline. You know, you just fly from signal post to signal light to signal light on these cross-country runs. Anyway, my next weekend, the car was there, and I went down as usual, as I'd done previously, and picked up Betty from her school, and again the girls all said, "Betty, here's your escort." Was it escort? She said, "Anyway, here's your escort to take you home." And I again took her home, and it was the third week, which would have been the last week of my period at that training school would have occurred, that the difficulties occurred, because when I went to pick Betty up, she really, all the girls said is, here's your boyfriend, you know, here's your boyfriend come for you, Betty, you better go, you know, made a fuss about it all. And anyway, that was going to be my last weekend with her parents before I went on to the next station. And I sort of thanked the family at the end of my weekend stay that time. I thanked the family and said goodbye to them. And I said to Betty, "Well, thank you for giving me a lovely time. I've had a lovely time here, Betty. But I'm afraid I shan't be seeing you again unless you come over to Great Britain." And she said, "Oh, not to worry, not to worry." She said, "Daddy's arranged that you can stay over here as an instructor so that we can get married." Oh, I really dropped through the floor. And I didn't want to say I'm married with a little girl. I said, "No, Betty," I said, "my intention, my whole object of coming over here is to fly so that I can get back to Great Britain and fight the Germans who are attacking us." I said, "And I come from London where we've had the heaviest of bombing, and I must get back there and get flying to defend the country." She went into a, you know, weeping and crying and so on, and at any rate, I had to leave, and I didn't say anything about being married, but I think the parents must have realised what the situation was, because I was quite a few years older than Betty. She was 17 and I was, what, 25, 26, 27, something like that, a mature person. And so I got posted to the next, the advanced training school, which we were flying Harvard's, AT-6As. And this was at Dothan in Alabama.
Was there a postscript for Betty?
Well, there is. There is, but I can tell you now what happened, that when I got to Dothan in Alabama, there was a telegram for me: "Would I please get in touch with Mrs. Lipfoot, because because Betty had run away from school and refused to go back, and would I go and could I take the time to go back to Macon and appease the situation?" Well, I don't know how I did it. It must have been 600 miles, and I'd got absolutely no money. You know, a few dollars in my pocket, and I think I hitchhiked one weekend. I hitchhiked from Dothan down to Macon in Georgia and visited the Lipfoots and put the story right. By which time I know that Mrs. Lipfoot had discovered that I was married, but she didn't put it to me that. Fortunately, I hadn't misbehaved, you know, I hadn't let the side down as far as other than enjoying dancing and entertainment with Betty. But of course, the American girls, when they dance with you, they put their arms around your neck and they cuddle into you and so on, more intimately than we ever thought of doing over here.